The Talks on China podcast is back, and we will be talking to experts on all things China and how Britain should respond to challenges from the Chinese Communist Party as often as we can. We'll be hitting on topics such as the current state of the Chinese Communist Party, Chinese tech totalitarianism, AI, and even espionage, and going in depth on breaking news. I'm Alicia Kearns, MP, Chair of the China Research Group and Foreign Affairs Committee. I will be your host. And this week, I am delighted to be joined by Professor Steve Tsang to talk about Chinese influence in British universities. Before we go into detail on that, Steve, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm Steve Tsang. I was born in Hong Kong and I went to Oxford in 1981. And after I finished, I stayed there for 29 and a half years altogether. Spent five years in the University of Nottingham and then moved to SOAS in 2016 and still am at SOAS.
Brilliant. Well, look, Steve, you have been in the news recently. So I think the first question I have to ask you is, have you ever been censored by the Chinese Communist Party?
I have not been censored by the Chinese Communist Party. I was asked on one occasion by my previous vice chancellor at the University of Nottingham to not make any media appearance for 1 week, which happens to be the week when Xi Jinping was on a state visit to the UK.
Interesting. So this is the context for listeners, is that Channel 4's Dispatches documentary has said that Nottingham University closed its School of Contemporary Chinese Studies in 2016 as a result of pressure from Beijing. And that as part of this, Steve was asked not to do any media interviews while Xi Jinping was in the country. Steve, you were head of the institute at the time. What really happened?
Well, it's a very complicated and convoluted story. And
perfect for a podcast.
I would only be able to say anything about what I know. There would be other sides of stories that I didn't know. I was asked by the universities to head up the school because they were thinking that the school wasn't being run exactly as what an academic school should be run at a Russell Group university. And it was really to make it into a normal academic school in a Russell Group university. That was my remit. And that's what I did. There were quite a lot of challenges along the way. It was a school with a very, very high percentage of academic staff who had hailed from the PRC, from mainland China. I want to underline that colleagues from mainland China are very, very diverse. Some of them are just as professional as any other British academics. Some work more closely with the Chinese embassy, and in one case, clearly with the party directly. And there were therefore challenges that had to be met. The university was very supportive for the changes that were being made. And we were, in fact, I was asking the top management at the university to increase the senior management by one professor when the vice chancellor in charge took it to the management board. And he came back and said that the vice chancellor had decided to close the school instead.
And do you know why? You don't know for certain, but why do you think that decision was made to close it down? Because, you know, we all want to see increased understanding of China, better Mandarin instruction across the country. Why would Nottingham close its centre?
Well, as I say, the vice chancellor, whom I knew, did not ask me to go to see him. So he did not tell me why his reason was, nor did he communicate his reasons through the vice chancellor to me directly. And he simply said that that was something that he had decided that it would have to be done. My own speculation, and I can't underline more strongly that it is purely my own understanding of the situation, was that he was finding it on between two sides of things. One was what he had wanted me to do with the school, and on the other side, there would be pressure that would be putting on him that was something that he judged as unbearably strong. Mm-hmm. And he decided that the easiest outcome perhaps would have been closing the school rather than trying to get me to change course.
So can I ask then, you talk about how some members of the staff were engaging with, let's put it politely, with the PRC and with the Chinese embassy here in the UK. For what purpose? I mean, why would the embassy have any interest in how a centre of excellence was working or how a centre at university was working?
Well, that you will really have to ask the Chinese embassy, who will obviously not comment. But having a Russell Group university, which would be very, very friendly in terms of facilitating certain types of events, would be helpful and beneficial to the Chinese embassy. The first thing I did when I became head of school there was to separate the directorship of the Confucius Institute at the institution at the School of Contemporary Chinese Studies from the headship of the School of Contemporary Chinese Studies. I did that for the simple reasons that I don't think it is appropriate that the head of school should concurrently be the head of the Confucius Institute. But by removing the headship of the directorship of the Confucius Institute from the headship, it meant that a significant budget that a person who is dual-headed would be able to control was taken out of the hands of the head of school. That, in a sense, was exactly also one of the reasons why I did that. I think that creates all kinds of problems. But that was something which I think they were very unhappy about.
Well, you've raised lots of interesting topics there, from Confucius Institutes to the interests of the Chinese Communist Party in what takes place on British campuses. But before we come back to those, I'd love to talk about your recent article, Xi's Student Spy Army and How They Can Be Outsmarted, which was in for The Times, for those who might want to have a read of it afterwards. Can you talk us through what you meant when you talked about Xi Jinping, that is, of course, having a student spy army in the UK?
Well, it is perhaps not Xi Jinping's personal army or agents, as it is something which the Communist Party United Front Work Department will have managed. The party and also the Chinese embassy have very strong contact with the different elements of the Chinese communities in the UK, including the student bodies. There are some students, and again, I underline that we are talking about some, we are by no means talking anything like all Chinese students, who are working closely with the embassy, and they sometimes report back to the embassy as to what actually are happening. Even though their number may not actually be very large, the fact that it is happening means that other students from China are not sure whether some amongst their friends group were in fact reporting to the embassy or to the party, which create an atmosphere of people effectively self-censoring, and in some cases who refuse to self-censor being put in a very difficult position. So that kinds of issues are things that regrettably on British university campuses, academics and academic leaders will have to bear in mind, and for the simple reason that we have a duty of care to all our students wherever they come from, and we need to make sure that they have a safe space when they are on our campuses.
Absolutely. So you're suggesting there's a dual prong goal of the Chinese Communist Party or the United Work Front, which is to essentially either A, report back on those who are not promoting or telling well China's story, and secondly, to shut down dissent and harangue, for example, Hong Kongers and others who we've seen on and across British universities sharing concerns. But how is this dissent? You know, how are these spies organised? Does the Chinese Communist Party have associations? Is it individuals who are recruited once they get into university? Are they proactively putting people into our universities? How are these relationships made?
Well, I think it is a bit of all, if not, well, at least most, if not all of them. There are some people who would have come to our universities entirely on basis of merit, but before they came, are very loyal and staunch members of the Communist Party, and they would perform the duties as good party members are supposed to perform. There are others who are recruited since they joined individually. And there are also institutions like the Chinese Scholars and Students Associations, which by and large maintain very, very, very close contacts with the education or the cultural section in the embassy in London. or for those who are in the north with the consulates in Manchester or in Scotland.
And just to dig into that Students and Scholars Association, because many listeners won't have heard of that before, how long has it existed? What is its supposed purpose? And can we draw a distinct line between them and the United Workers' Front?
The Chinese Scholars and Students Association, usually called CSSA for short, have existed on British campuses practically since Chinese students were admitted in numbers back in the, I should say, the early 1980s, after the opening up of China in the Deng Xiaoping era. Now, they came into existence, I think, entirely intending to be a kind of student welfare association helping fellow Chinese students and scholars who left China when China was in a situation not that fundamentally different from North Korea, having to adapt to the conditions in the United Kingdom or other Western democratic countries. So there was a fair bit of adjustments. Now, at some stage, these CSSAs came under the advice, support, supervision, or a combination of them, or part of them, by various sections in the in Chinese embassies. And this is something that happens not only in the UK, it happens in other countries too. And I am aware that, for example, in 1989, when the enormous protests were happening in Beijing, what we now call the Tiananmen movement, that some student unions or CSSAs in certain universities having had meetings late into the early hours of the morning would have some of their members being rang up by somebody from the education section in the Chinese embassy bright and early the following morning and being told what they had said in the previous a few hours earlier. So clearly somebody was reporting back to the embassy, but we would not be able to know exactly who was doing that. There were suspicions that people were expressing at the time, but proof, concrete proof, was much more difficult to get.
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting you talk about this because I remember my mother in the 70s was on the London Underground as a young woman, and she saw on the tube opposite her a young man in a Mao suit, and she picked up conversation with him because, you know, this was her first ever physical sighting, you know, close proximity to a Chinese person. And they actually struck up a friendship. And I remember she invited him to come to her home. And she had a group of people come over for a political discussion. And when he arrived, Mao suit, little red book in his pocket, everything else, he turned up with two other students, or reportedly students. And it became quite obvious as the evening went on that they were there to mind him, to be very careful, to be monitoring exactly what he was saying. Who were these radical leftist students that this man had found himself meeting with, and to control him and report back on what he did. So actually, that was the first group of students that had ever been allowed to study outside of China at that time. I remember the Chinese government sent some to Russia, some to the US, some to the UK, and I think possibly to France or Germany. So it's fascinating how seeing from the moment students were allowed to leave China, this kind of tool of management and control was put in place that has now been extended to the wider populations. But can I ask you, in terms of what that means in terms of the ability of the Chinese Communist power to exercise influence over those universities, do you see, and obviously there's a big discussion in the UK at the moment about student numbers, we all operate on the premise that we want students from abroad, and not all Chinese students are people to be told not to come and study here. But do you see risks, or have you seen examples of the Chinese Communist Party weaponizing the number of Chinese students who are in our universities?
Yes, I have seen evidence of that. But no, I don't think that is a reason for us not to welcome Chinese students. We also have to make a distinction between students coming for the STEM subjects who would therefore potentially be accessing technologies and other informations that potentially have national security implications for the UK.
And we should say on that that students or civilians are required to provide to the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, technical information on technical advantage, advancement and sharing of knowledge that they have access to, if that's right.
Well, that is correct. Under the Civil Military fusion policy of Xi Jinping, anybody who have access to technology and information and skills that the PLA requires can be asked to make that available. Doesn't mean that people would necessarily want to choose to share that information, but if asked, they don't really have a choice.
And we have seen videos of students. I think there's one very famous one from Cambridge where there was a young man with a USB stick running around putting it into every single universe, in a single computer before he left the university. So although, you know, this isn't a mass concern, there are actual evidence bases of this.
There are some cases of that, but I would offer the opinions that I still believe that the overwhelming majority of students are not doing that.
Absolutely.
They are really here to learn and to have a good time. And there are also a large number of Chinese students who are coming here to study in the humanities and in the social sciences. And so I think there is a lot for us to be said about welcoming the students in the humanities and the social sciences with open arms. We want them to understand what we are. They can do so in a very critical way. They don't have to agree with what we do and what we advocate. But it would be useful for them to see that.
Absolutely. So we want the brightest and the best to come to the best universities in the world, and those are the ones in the UK. So is that the distinction that you would draw, that we should be accepting fewer students on STEM or with higher criteria they have to meet in order to make sure they're not reporting back to the PLA, but embrace as many as we can within the humanities? You know, what's your advice to how universities manage what is an incredibly difficult situation whereby we don't want to close our door to all Chinese students? Absolutely not. So what do universities do about this?
With all due respect, I don't think that is something that we should leave it to universities, which may come across as being very odd coming from a career academic, because what we are dealing with here are matters of national security.
Mm-hmm.
Universities are not institutions that are very good at looking after national security. That's the job of the government of the United Kingdom. And I think what we need is for the governments to say which are the kind of subjects that are sensitive in terms of national security, and therefore students from certain countries cannot enroll to those programs. But any of the other programs which are not specifically listed, then universities just do what universities do. We exchange, we recruit, and we engage, and we do research, and we do teaching as normal.
That's a very helpful and pragmatic approach. And would you say the same guidelines are best extended to researchers and academics themselves? Because obviously we've seen, you know, partnerships, for example, on very sensitive technologies such as railgun technologies, on AI, lots of universities getting into deep relationships also with parts of the Chinese military. So what's the way in which we approach this with academia? Is it the exact same approach, or do you think that academics themselves have a higher standard to meet, given that they're not young people looking to going out on the first freedoms of life?
Well, again, with all due respect to fellow academics, we are a kind of geeks. Academics are not normal people. Let's be honest about it. Academics are egoistic, full of themselves, devoted to their subjects. That's why we become academics.
You might get in trouble with a few of your colleagues for those comments, Steve.
I will get into trouble with all my academic colleagues. But that being what we are, our inclination is to engage with everybody who has something to offer. We don't think about national security. That is not what we normally do. So again, what we really need is the government basically saying that these are the kind of areas that you can't collaborate, and anything else, then we go back to the good old common law tradition. What is not prohibited is permitted, and what is permitted, you do freely to the best of your ability.
That's very helpful.
And I think that is the best way for us to proceed.
So in terms of then funding, which is the next kind of next chain, look, there is a Civitas report that came out that suggested to up a third of all UK university funding is made up by Chinese funding. including entities explicitly linked to the People's Liberation Army. We know that the biggest single source of funding is Huawei. And despite the 5G ban having been brought in by Parliament, more than £14 million has been invested into UK universities by the country, by the company, with £10 million alone going to just Edinburgh University. So what do we do in terms of the funding and making sure that universities are making the right decisions when it comes to Chinese funding in our universities?
Well, again, I think the problem here really isn't so much with China or with universities. I think the problem here is really with the government here. The government can't have the cake and eat it.
Yeah.
The Communist Party is the Communist Party of China. It will do what the Communist Party of China always do. And it will take advantage of our universities and other institutions if it could. Universities will do what it wants to do, which is that we have some of the world's best universities, and we are among the world's best universities because we are open, because we are focused on pushing boundaries, which means that we are inclined to accept collaboration and funding that look legitimate to us.
Mm.
So anything that the regular university processes would not have thrown up as a problem, we will engage. Now, what we are dealing with is a reality that UK's relationship and the UK's understanding of our relationship with China have changed.
Mm.
It wasn't that long ago when the signal from HMG was that we were in a golden era of wonderful relationship with China. So why would university not feel comfortable accepting money from Huawei or other Chinese funding institutions? Now, the reality is that has changed. UK government doesn't think that any longer. And therefore, what was previously acceptable have become unacceptable. So suddenly, if universities forsake all those financial inputs, a lot of the projects, many, many projects would have to be shut down. Many research will have to be stopped. And some people will have to lose their jobs. Now, that's not what universities would want to do. So if the UK government really wants to make sure that doesn't happen, it has to make that support available to universities for the universities to be able to extricate themselves from those financial arrangements. It's not, I don't think, a very responsible thing for the HMG to simply say that now we don't want universities to be linked financially with Chinese institutions, so you just all forsake that.
I think that's a really valid challenge.
And the same thing applies to students from China. Some universities are now very heavily dependent on incomes from Chinese students. And suddenly, if university have to lose all those Chinese students, they will get into a financial crisis.
I think this is a really big challenge. And, you know, there have been reports of, for example, British MPs whose children have wanted to study at certain British universities, but were told, we can't accept your child because you are sanctioned and we have been told we will lose our Chinese funding. I mean, that's a direct example of influence. But on the funding, I mean, to look at some of the partnerships universities are doing, you know, China's largest hypersonic missile technology testing institute is a partner. China's primary nuclear warheads research centre has contributed 7.3 million to British universities. You know, its large supply of precision guided missiles. This isn't easy. And you're right that while we're in this transition period, the UK government probably should be looking at how they provide that guidance. Now, we're starting to run out of time, but I did want to cover with you Confucius Institutes briefly, because this is something that people often don't understand. So it'd be really helpful. So we know that Confucius Institutes are funded by the Chinese government. They are meant to be Chinese language and cultural centres abroad. At their best, you could consider them a form of soft power. At the worst, you could say that they are propaganda sites who bring people together and offer an alternative vision of China and of its past. What is your experience of Confucius Institutes?
Well, my personal experience with Confucius Institute is that they are very diverse. I mean, some of them do engage in very problematic activities, which I would myself find unacceptable. I've also come across Confucius Institutes that don't do any of those things, that they basically don't do much of anything at all.
Can you give us an example of the sort of behaviours you've seen that you found to be unacceptable without naming which Confucius Institutes they are?
Now, for example, if you have a Confucius Institute at a Russell Group University, which also had a Chinese studies department, and the Confucius Institute wants to invite some speakers from China that would not normally meet the criteria to be selected as a speaker at a Russell Group University. But since the Confucius Institute happens to be in that Russell Group University and probably have the headship of it being the same as the head of that Chinese Studies department, then you will have a situation when the Confucius Institute effectively paid for somebody coming from China to speak at a Russell Group University who otherwise would not have been accepted to speak at a Russell Group University and speaking effectively Chinese government propaganda. Now, I would find that unacceptable. I think universities have to make a distinction. I think the real issue with the Confucius Institutes are two things. One, ultimately, all Confucius Institutes are superintended by the propaganda department of the Chinese Communist Party. That's where the ultimate line of management rests. So Confucius Institutes really are not comparable to British Council offices or that of the German or the French equivalent. Confucius Institutes are much more like USIA, US Information Agencies. And we would never contemplate accepting USIA being on our campus delivering American studies because it is part of the US government. And to be fair, the USIA has never tried to do that. They have always operated independently, clearly labeled as a department of the US government.
Absolutely.
Now, if the Confucius Institute operate like that independently, clearly identifying what they are, I don't have a problem with that. We are a free society. We accept them. We accept the USIA office as we can accept Confucius Institute that are freestanding. The problem is where they try to embed themselves on university campuses or school campuses, pretending to be independent academic institutions, then I think we've got a problem.
Absolutely. And I should point out that last year, the China Research Group put forward an amendment to the Freedom of Speech Bill, and we were successful. So we now have a position whereby the British government has the ability, if a Confucius Institute is be found to be breaching freedom of speech. So, for example, we see Hong Kongers told they can't speak out, or students participating where they're being told that Tiananmen Square never happened, the Xinjiang, you know, essentially people feeling that they are being monitored, controlled and unable to have freedom of speech. The government now has the ability to shut down those sites. So that's a really important move forward. Steve, final question for you. I'm really worried by the rising levels of intimidation we are seeing around the world, but also in England, of Hong Kongers on British streets, including students. Can you just give us an idea, why do you think we're seeing such an increase in violence? You know, people wearing balaclavas and attacking peaceful Hong Kong and Uyghur activists on our streets.
The problem here fundamentally comes from the very top of the Chinese leadership. Xi Jinping has time and again famously said that Chinese patriots and government officials or party members or just patriots should not be afraid to unsheathe their swords and show their swords in defense of the honor of China. So if you see someone who is saying something or doing something which you, as a Chinese patriot, feels would have been counted as dishonoring China or its leadership or its government, then you have the right to do whatever it takes to defend the dignity of China. So you will have people who were not necessarily being told by the Communist Party to go and attack people, but feel that I heard this other person who happens to be a Uyghur or a Hong Kong person saying things about the Communist Party of China or about Xi Jinping, which I found offensive. Therefore, I go out and defend the honor of China, as my top leader has told me to do, as a good Chinese patriot. I think this is where the problems really comes up with. And effectively, nobody who's done that would not be seen as a good patriotic person by the Chinese authorities. So effectively, nobody's being punished for that, not by the Chinese authorities. So why would the people not continue to do so?
Well, on that note, that's all from us at Talks on China. Steve, thank you ever so much for giving us your time, and I'm sure we'll speak to you again on another podcast.
Thank you.